Virginia will be reading the story.
Hey everybody, I'm an addict named Dan. This member from Ireland grew up quiet and withdrawn, but recovery helped him overcome his fear of speaking in public to find his voice and himself. Speaking up. I was a quiet kid. Being quiet worked for me. When things got difficult, I found that an impenetrable silence was usually my best defense. I have a photograph of myself, aged about 10, which shows a very solemn little boy gazing up at the camera. It reminds me what it was like growing up in the kind of home where it was often wiser to keep to myself. Even at that age, I constantly sought an escape and spent much of my childhood lost in reading. Times I pulled my head out of the book long enough to speak up, my fears were only reinforced. At the age of 11, I was chosen to do a reading at the service where I'd be confirmed to the Catholic Church. My family were all there, as well as the local archbishop. Although I wasn't overburdened with faith, I knew this was important and really didn't want to mess it up. When one of the priests came over and asked in a whisper if I was ready, I immediately launched into the passage. Spoken in a loud, clear voice, my amplified words echoed around the huge church. When the reading was finished, I sensed something was wrong and looked up to find the archbishop staring at me over his glasses. I felt a sudden stab of shame as I realized I'd been supposed to wait for him to speak first. It was one of those moments that seemed to go on forever. As they began the ceremony in earnest, I felt very small and very wrong, and I hated it. This helped instill in me a dread of speaking in public. Later on in life, I found out that many people were more afraid of public speaking than they were of death. That made a lot of sense to me. This phobia was only made worse when my hormones kicked in and I suddenly found myself the owner of what was, for a 13-year-old, a remarkably deep baritone voice. I was very self-conscious about the subsonic rumble that came out every time I opened my mouth and the effect it had on people when they first heard it. I also started using around this time. All the reading paid off. I'd done lots of research into the different kinds of drugs, and I was already looking forward to working my way through the menu. I told myself as long as I didn't cross the line by taking one particular drug, I'd be fine. As my teenage years progressed, I got more heavily into drugs. I found that when I used, it helped me to talk to people. Of course, when I say people, I really mean girls. When I wasn't using, I would fall back into a rigid silence. After a while, all I could talk about with any degree of confidence was drugs. In my adult years, the only reason I wasn't fired from my job was that I wasn't self-employed, though it wasn't very helpful to my professional reputation being regularly searched on the street by the local drug squad. I could only put so much of my unmanageable behavior down to my artistic temperament. When my family and colleagues tried to find out what was going on with me, they were met with a stony-faced silence. The only people who really knew what kind of a life I was leading were the people I used with. I was experiencing terrible feelings of inadequacy and self-loathing that even the drugs didn't seem to be able to mask anymore. I had long since crossed the line I'd set myself. All I had to look forward to was crossing the lines I hadn't even thought of. Then one of my friends started going to NA meetings. Although I desperately wanted to get clean, the idea of spilling my guts out in front of a room full of strangers filled me with such acute anxiety that I resolved to find another way. I tried substituting drugs, only using when I had a certain combination of drugs, and started seeing a counselor. Nothing worked. I could stop using, but I couldn't stop thinking about drugs. It seemed that the only way to stop thinking about them was to use them. Of course, as soon as I used, the next thought would always be, I have to stop doing this. Eventually, I couldn't see any other way, so I called my friend and she took me to my first meeting. When I got there, I recognized the people in the room. Some of them I'd met before from school or from using, but in a way I recognized all of them. They were like me and I was like them. In one way, they weren't like me in that they didn't seem to take themselves as terribly seriously as I did. In fact, some of them were actually laughing and at themselves. And more significantly, they were talking about all the feelings, fears, and insecurities that I had been carrying around all my life. I had always thought that I was the only one who'd ever had them. It was a very profound experience, and I felt at home for the first time in a very long while. This feeling was rapidly replaced by mounting horror as I realized that the meeting was around Robin. The sharing was making its way around the room towards me. I remember wishing as hard as I possibly could that the meeting would finish before they got to me. Of course, it didn't. So out of politeness, I said my name, that I was an addict, and that I really didn't like talking about myself. That's all I could say at my first NA meeting. Even though I felt that I was only calling myself an addict to fit in, when I said the words, something shifted in me. I didn't know it at the time, but I had just started working the first step. Now, I would love to say that as soon as I started to experience the love and acceptance that came to me from the people in the rooms, it immediately took away my fear of speaking publicly, but it didn't. I had to overcome something in me in order to be able to share. If anything, once I realized that I needed to talk about myself, sharing in meetings became even more difficult because I had not knowing what I was talking about. Around the time, it also became apparent that for me, sharing was comparing. I was surrounded by people who seemed so much more clever, more articulate, and funnier than me. Every time I opened my mouth, I struggled to speak through an avalanche of not good enough thoughts. Obviously, a lot of these thoughts were reflected in what I was sharing. There was more than a little of beating myself up coming from my corner of the room. It seemed that when I shared, what popped up to the surface first were all my character defects, to the point that I sometimes thought that they were all that I had inside me. In hindsight, I can see that this was a pretty useful process, though it wasn't too comfortable at the time. As well as my voice, my accent marked me out as someone from a different part of town from many of the people in the meetings. At first, I was tempted to adjust my accent to fit in better. But even then, I could see that this was just another way of not feeling good enough. For the longest time, I was unmerciful with myself when I shared, obsessing about what different people in the room could be thinking about what I'd said. It took quite a while for me to realize that many of them were probably just as self-obsessed as I was. Nearly 2 years clean, I went to a European convention and was sharing in my usual low murmur at a marathon meeting when a brash voice called on me to speak louder. As I went up a notch in volume to a quiet murmur, I had the awful thought that for the last 2 years, maybe no one at home had heard a word I'd said, that they'd all been too polite to tell me and I was going to have to start all over again. The thing was that even though on some deep level, I felt that I'd never be any good at sharing, that I'd never have the ease that I heard in other members around me, it was vitally important that I continue to try. All the times that I opened my mouth and nothing that seemed to make any sense came out, or even worse, the many times I just dried up completely and even thought inside I died a little every time this happened, I knew I had to keep going because I needed to share to be a part of NA. Deep down, I knew I needed to be a part of NA if I was going to survive. Up until then, my way of looking at life had been pretty simple. If at first you don't succeed, give up. It was most unusual for me to be faced with this constant failure, and as I saw it, and nevertheless, to keep going. One thing that really helped was when I started to realize that all the criticism was coming from inside me, and that what I was getting from the people around me in meetings was encouragement and approval. After the first few years passed, I even began to let go and accept that an easy, expressive way of sharing would always be beyond me, but that just because I couldn't share as well as the people I admired didn't mean I was any less of a recovering addict than they were. I started really working the steps, and one of the immediate ways that I could see the benefits was that the more I worked them, the easier it became for me to share openly and honestly. So, as had already been happening in many other areas, the miracles started happening in this part of my life. A lot of it had to do with practice, which is the only way I've ever become good at anything in recovery, including working the steps, sponsoring members, and doing service. Rather than always seeing it as a necessary evil, I started to feel more relaxed about sharing in meetings and actually started to enjoy it occasionally. I was even asked by my professional association to chair some of their meetings, a skill I'd learned through doing service in NA. Then, when my grandfather died a few years ago, my family asked me to give a eulogy at his funeral. Having been the black sheep during my using, being asked to be of service like this meant a great deal to me. I prepared a short eulogy, adding the words, "Speak slowly," in big block letters on the top of the page. As I walked up to the pulpit, I prayed for the ability to do what I needed to do. When I got there, I took a deep breath and spoke from the heart about this man I admired so much and how proud our family was of him. When it was over, the congregation applauded, and I walked back down to sit beside my mother. Her eyes were shining with pride, and I felt very grateful to NA for all the help I'd been given in rising to the challenge. The miracles continued to this day and showed no signs of letting up. Last year, long after I'd given up on ever being asked, I was the main speaker at our regional convention. As the moment of truth approached, my nerves were jangling. An old timer at my table leaned over and said quietly, "Just be yourself." I took his advice, and to my surprise and delight, I actually enjoyed speaking in front of pretty much all of the local fellowship. As I neared the end of my share, there was a polite applause when I mentioned that I've done everything right in recovery. This was followed by laughter when I pointed out that I've also done everything wrong. And when I pointed out that the greatest mistake I've ever made in recovery was thinking that I wasn't good enough, I could feel the waves of identification from the members washing over me with their applause. I'm very grateful to Narcotics Anonymous for so many things, not least for the ability to survive long enough to truly get to know and value myself. There have been many awakenings and miracles along the way, and one of the most important for me was that through the meetings and program of NA, I have found my voice. And through finding my voice, I have found myself.
Yes, that's me. Hi, my name's Connor. I'm an addict.
Hold on there. Everybody's clapping, but they're not hearing you. Can somebody unmute?
Can you hear me now?
Joe, can you unmute everybody? Okay.
You can hear you, Connor.
Okay, at this time I'd like
to hear me, Francis.
Yes.
I need to turn up the volume.
At this time. At this time I'd like to introduce Connor from Dublin.
Hi everybody. My name's Connor. I'm an addict. Thank you very much, Dan. That was very well read. This is the second time I've done this, and I'm kind of glad, because the first time I remember it just was bizarre hearing my own story being read to me. I'd never had that experience before. And, you know, I've also never had the experience of being a rock band waiting in wings to go on while a cover band were doing versions of my songs, but that's probably as close as it felt like, listening to my story being read out in somebody else's voice. But, you know, this time, you know, it's funny. I heard stuff in there that I'd kind of forgotten. And I remember, you know, when the guys in Paradise asked me to do this a couple of months ago, I think that was in our first lockdown. And I remember thinking afterwards, I think that went quite well, but I have no idea what I said, so I'm not going to I'm not going to retread what I said the last time. And actually, what I was kind of thinking about, and you know, listening to some of the earlier speakers inspired me as well. Was I want to just talk a little bit about what you know how things have changed for me since I wrote that story. I know that the last time. I shared after the story, I kind of went into a bit more detail about the story. And actually, one of the details that has only just occurred to me, I'm going to mention in a minute or two. But, you know, much like Monica was saying, you know, around the time 2004, 2006, I was as heavily involved in service as I've ever been. And, you know, at the World Conference and at the European Delegates meeting. And, you know, we'd been in and out of kind of, I'd first gone to the European Delegates meeting in 1988. I first met Monica in Rome in 1990, I think, 1991, around that time. And actually, and it is just great as well for me to look at the screen here and see some people I haven't seen in a very long time. I met Boniface in Nairobi in 2004. And went to a couple of meetings with him there, and I'm really, really glad to see him and to hear him as well. There's a lot to kind of overcome. There are a lot of challenges to overcome in this kind of moment in time with COVID and everything. But yeah, can you hear me? Okay, good. It would be kind of ironic if you couldn't hear me after listening to that story. Where's the subtitle button? Also, I'm aware that some of you may not fully understand my Irish accent or my Irish dry sense of humor, but there's not a lot I can do about that, so we're just going to have to go with it, you know? So. Yeah, I mean, the one thing I would say about that story, and it really kind of, it brought me back to that moment. And actually, I was remembering in the story where I was in the church, which is just a couple of miles away from me now, and I made that boo-boo, and I spoke instead of the Archbishop. And, you know, he was a kind of a, you know, an unforgiving, harsh man. You know, he was in charge of the church. He was in charge of stuff. You know, he didn't kind of look kindly upon me, and kind of, you know, forgive me, you know, which is a very fucking Christian thing to do. So excuse me, I will swear a bit, but I'm Irish, so I get a license to do that. I can see the other Irish person on the screen there laughing at that. Hi, Selena. You know, but no, he didn't forgive me. But actually, the really important thing, I remember we went off afterwards, you know, the family, and nobody in the family put their arm around me and said, don't worry about it. It's okay. It was just a mistake. It doesn't matter. So I just, that's why, you know, like so many other things in life, you know, two things happened. I didn't get that comfort. I didn't get that kind of forgiveness. And I didn't find it. I couldn't find it in myself to ask for it. You know, that was probably the big, big thing. I couldn't say, you know, I feel all fucked up about what just happened, you know, you know, tell me I'm doing okay, you know. And if nothing else, you know, I mean, there have been so many, many changes in my life and in me since I came into recovery. But if nothing else, you know, I mean, aside from, you know, being clean, from which all other good things follow. But if, you know, in terms of kind of changes and stuff like that, you know, the fact that I'm now able to turn to somebody I love and trust and say, oh boy, I messed up, I feel terrible, and for them, and let them put their arms around me and say, it's okay, don't worry about it, don't take it so seriously, it's fine, they didn't even notice, you know, or whatever, you know, that has made me more of a human being than I ever used to be, and I'm very grateful for that. writing of that, and it was really nice listening to Monica again, kind of talking about writing that. And, you know, I have been a professional writer amongst other things that I've done in my life. And, you know, like most professional writers, writing is really, really difficult, you know. I mean, one of the great American novelists, I can never remember which one, said writers are people for whom writing is more difficult than it is for most people, you know. Because, you know, when you write something, you rewrite it, and you rewrite it, and you rewrite it, and you, it's just never good enough. You kind of keep going. And that, you know, I remember, you know, again, when it came up that, you know, more stories were needed for the basic text. And I didn't think mine would be picked, but I just thought, you know, this will be a good thing to do. This will be a good thing just for myself. And I knew some people in the office, and I was a friend of Travis's. And like, if, you know, basically, you know, let's be honest, if Travis said, you know, Connor, that's a lovely effort and I enjoyed reading it, it's not getting in the book, but thanks for trying anyway, I would have been delighted. You know, if I got Travis to kind of give me a thumbs up, that would have been great, you know? And maybe because of that, you know, rather than the usual kind of agonizing and, you know, teeth pulling thing that writing often is for me, it just flowed, you know, it absolutely just flowed. And, you know, I don't know why that is. I don't, you know, I wish I did, because then, you know, if I was then able to connect with that part of myself on a more regular basis, I'd be able to write a lot more and a lot more easily. But it was one of those times, and I've had a number of times in recovery when, you know, often they've been kind of crisis moments when I went to confront the pregnant mother of my son after discovering that she'd gone back using and we were living together. This is in very, very early recovery in the first couple of months. And, you know, just, you know, I'd been afraid to say anything to her. I'd been afraid to acknowledge, you know, I'd been in my own kind of deep denial about the fact I was living with a using addict and she'd been hiding it from me, and it had come up, and I just went, and whatever I said to her was the right thing. You know, it was almost like being in a state of grace. It was almost like, you know, and I didn't feel I was channeling kind of God or anything like that. I just felt I was connected with something deep inside myself. And that was probably, you know, that ability to kind of connect with my authentic self was, you know, the exact thing I'd spent all of my active addiction avoiding doing. You know, I remember hearing somebody talking about kind of early recovery, and made a great turn of phrase, and they said, you know, I didn't want to look into my mind. I had a mind full of broken glass, you know. Like, if you go in there, you get hurt. You know, there are sharp edges. There are things in there that will cut you, you know. And, you know, I'd spent so much of my active addiction not having insight, not being connected to others, not being connected to myself, because it was painful. And I was medicating, and I was, you know, it was all about pain management. And somehow being in recovery, even in the very, very early days, like that one, that instance I just mentioned, I had moments of connecting to, you know, a really deep and strong and true part of myself. And it making a difference, it actually making a serious difference in what went on in my life. So again, that's something I'm really, really grateful for. I just have to acknowledge at this point as well, I'm kind of exhausted. I mean, it's not that late in Ireland, but we've been in lockdown for a long time. And last night, my girlfriend and I went to dinner and a movie. You know, Jesus Christ. And then today we went to an art gallery and we had lunch in town and there were people around. And I'm, you know, I just came back here and I think, you know, I'm wildly overstimulated here. I'm exhausted. So, you know, you're just getting me in need of a nap, you know, so I'm just going to push through, you know, I'm not going to have a nap, but just to kind of acknowledge that. And I suppose, you know, kind of, I wrote that story in 2006, maybe 2005, 2006. I think 2006 is when the basic text was published, the sixth edition. And I was in my mid-40s and I was 19 years clean. And I thought I kind of, I had pretty much a handle on most things, you know, I really did, you know. and I did have a handle on lots of things, but there are many other things that were really important that I still needed to get a much better handle on. And one of them was actually relationships. And again, just listening to Monica really brought that back to me. 4 years later, I was in, certainly up until that time, the most important relationship I'd ever been in my life. And, you know, I'm not proud to say this, but it's just the truth. You know, at that stage, I was 48 years old, and I was in love in the way that, you know, human beings love each other, not in the obsessive, teeth grinding, full of projection, you know, fantasy kind of way that had often been my experience up until then, but like proper, you know, messy, you know, dirty, you know, who's doing the dishes kind of love, you know. I was in that kind of love for the first time in my life. And it was wonderful. Oh my God, it was wonderful. And then it was over and it was awful. And, you know, for me, you know, it is not a badge of pride to reach your late 40s without having ever truly been heartbroken. You know, it's really not. Now, having said that, it's now 10 years later and I'm really glad it happened. I'm the better for it. But Jesus Christ, on a bike, it was tough going, you know. I remember, you know, one of the things, when even at the very beginning of that relationship, I remember, and I will never ever forget this, I was a couple of years older than her, well, maybe more than a couple, I was quite a few years older than her, and, you know, I felt a little insecure. I remember, you know, this is in the first couple of months, and I felt a little kind of unsure of myself and all this kind of stuff, and I ran a number on her, you know. I did, you know, like, I was, you know, I tried not to be manipulative. I tried not to be controlling. I tried not to be all of these things, that all of these kind of skills that I developed, like many of us had developed in addiction. I mean, like in addiction, like I remember once my mother ringing me to confront me about having found some drug kind of paraphernalia. And my girlfriend, who didn't know I was using, was across the room. And I managed to somehow tell my mother on the phone, imply that it was my girlfriend's rather than, you know, I'm sorry, this is all going to be very complicated, but basically I fucking finagled my way out of that situation like a black belt finagler, you know. My mother went off thinking, okay, so he's with somebody who's using drugs, you know, and my girlfriend didn't know that I was using drugs and that she'd just been blamed for me using drugs, you know. I mean, I have no idea how I did that, you know, but I was capable of that and far, far more. And then, you know, all these years later in recovery, I just run this kind of number. I just kind of do this number on my new girlfriend. And, you know, and I'm not trying deliberately to make her feel insecure. I'm not trying deliberately to kind of undermine her a little bit. I'm just trying to make her feel a bit jealous because I'm feeling a bit kind of do. And she just called me out. And she looked straight into my eyes and she said, Connor, I thought we were going to be kind to each other. Oh boy. You know, I mean, that was a proper, I want the ground to open up, and, you know, open up and swallow me up. And in the couple of years that we were together, I did that one other time. I pulled, you know, a kind of a head game like that on her. And almost as it was coming out of my mouth, I put my hand and said, I've just done it again. I'm really sorry. I'll never do it again. And I didn't. And I haven't. And, you know, the reason I'm kind of saying all this is because, you know, I've been through a lot of different things in recovery. And, you know, I really tried very hard. I did all of the actions that one needs to take in order to have a faith in a God or in a higher power. And I tried for years, and I prayed, and I meditated, and I did lots, and I talked to lots of people about it. And it came to me, you know, after many, many years, that it was just not me, you know, that some people were just not going to have that. And that's okay. And one of the wonderful things about NA is that all of us can find our own way, and we can find our own version of a higher power. And I'm not for a second saying that my girlfriend of 10 years ago was my higher power, far from it. But because I was in NA and because I was doing my very best to be honest and my very best to be open-minded and certainly willing to change, when these kind of moments of clarity would come along, you know, I heard them, you know, and for all I know, I might have had those moments of clarity like dozens of times before, and I just bat them off, or I'd be defensive, or I just wouldn't even get it in the first place. So my version of, you know, I mean, people talk about kind of get, you know, I don't believe in an, as the singer says, I don't believe in an interventionist God, but I do believe that there are great lessons out there if I'm willing to hear them. And that was one of them. And that's really why I wanted to share about it. And, you know, my son has given me other amazing lessons. And you know, people who are 2 days in the door of a meeting have given me amazing lessons who I've only ever seen once and never ever seen again. Like, it's all about being open to it and being kind of willing to hear it. Since that time... you know, it talks in the story about my mother's eyes shining with pride, you know, when I gave the eulogy at my grandfather's funeral, at her father's funeral, and that was quite a moment. And again, I was very, very sure and very clear that I would not have been able to have gone through that moment in the way that I did without my connection with NA. And 10 years after I wrote that story, my mother died, and I gave a eulogy at my mother's funeral. And it was a beautiful, it was a late fall, late autumn day. We're in the center of town, beautiful sunlight around the place. And I was outside just kind of greeting people, like, you know, Irish people do funerals really well, I have to say. Like, you know, it goes on for days, and there are wakes, and there's pre-funerals and post-funerals, and, you know, everybody goes down the pub, and, you know, there's a lot to it, and it's great, you know, it's I think it's really helpful. And, you know, there are a lot of, you know, I've done a lot of different works and lots of different kinds of areas, so there are lots of people from different parts of my life. And just outside the church, just in the corner, there was a whole bunch of guys just all, you know, huddled together as we do. Well, maybe not huddled, just hanging together as we do. And they're the guys from the men's meeting on a Friday night in Dublin, you know, that meeting that I started in 1995, you know. And I just saw them and they saw me. And, you know, it just kind of, it gave me such a boost. It, you know, it gave me such a... You know, whatever they wanted to, you know, whatever they were imparting to me, it just kind of, it flowed into me at that point, and it certainly helped give me whatever I needed to, in order to give my mother a good eulogy as well, you know. And I gave her an honest eulogy, you know. My aunt at the end came out, I talked about her, my son sent a letter, my two sisters talked about her, and her sister, my aunt, afterwards came up to me and said, I've never been at a funeral before where two of the deceased children described them as fierce. But my mother was a fierce woman. And, you know, I had to be honest. She was a fierce woman. You know, she had a, you know, there's a lot of things there, and her fierceness was one of them. It deserved to be acknowledged. You know? And it's now... you know, 14 years after doing that story. And it's funny as well, you know, I'm extremely proud of that story. I'm proud of it as a piece of writing. I'm extremely grateful that it got, you know, and as other people are saying, honored that it got picked. And, you know, in some ways I felt it wasn't really about me. I just knew I'd had such a difficult time getting okay with sharing, and I just knew that so many other people would be the same. And I just thought, well, you know, if I can articulate that in some way, if that is in any way helpful to other people, that Jesus, you know, I'm really, really glad that has happened. But, you know, I have an ego, you know, and I, you know, I'm kind of not shy of kind of telling people when I achieve things, but I've always kept that very quiet. Like, most, you know, very few people would know that I've written a story. My very close friends and family would know. My current girlfriend, I told her about it. So it was kind of strange for us all to be kind of outed publicly by this group in Paradise in California. But, you know, again, I've just learned to go with the flow. And if this is the flow, I'm happy to go with it. So thank you, Francis, and everybody out there. It's you know, I just looked it up on my calendar. In 2 weeks, happy birthday, Monica, by the way. In 2 weeks and one day, I will be 33 years clean. Yeah, and thank you. I'm really happy about that. I don't take it for granted. I'm really happy about that. You know, I'm still doing service. I'm running the meditation meeting at 6 o'clock Irish time on a Wednesday evening. You're all welcome to come. It's an unguided meditation for 15 minutes and then an open share. And, you know, I've gotten involved with Lynn is on this call somewhere as well. Lynn from New York. Myself and a couple of the other old farts in Ireland are now running eventually a kind of an NA Irish history project. And we're going in and looking at all the you know, the old stuff. And like, you know, we found this amazing, you know, the first meeting list with 6 meetings on it. You know, when I first came to meetings in 1987, there were 22 meetings in Ireland. And, you know, that was a couple of days. So I thought, well, you're never going to need any more than that, you know. And there's like well over 200 now, you know. Another time, a couple of years ago, when I first started going through the archive, I found, you know, another treasure, which is a postcard from Jimmy Kay to a loner member in the north, in Northern Ireland, you know. It's just wonderful to kind of have be tasked with kind of exploring and cataloging and eventually sharing all those treasures with the rest of the Irish Fellowship and the world, you know. So it's a nice lockdown project as well, I can say. So, you know, I'm enormously grateful for everything I've been given in NA, and you know, I do give back. I'll never be able to give back as much as I've been given, but you know, that's the same for all of us, so I'm okay with that. And I love you all, and I'll leave it at that. Thank you.
Thank you, Connor.
Thank you, Connor.
Connor. Connor. Connor. Connor. Connor. Connor. Connor. Connor. Wonderful.
Yay.